The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
If you travel for business, you know it's a game of wins and losses. Popping open an overhead bin and finding it empty, win. Sleeping through a wake-up call, loss. Buying your business trip at Upside.com? That's not just a win, it's a triple win. Number one, Upside has the absolute best available prices for flights, hotel, and rental cars. Win number two is that Upside will reward you with a gift card to places like Amazon.com every time you buy a business trip. And number three is the amazing six-star treatment you'll get from Upside's customer service specialist, who they call Navigators. Go to Upside.com and use the code FTN, and you'll get a minimum $100 gift card to Amazon.com. That's code FTN for a minimum $100 gift card to Amazon.com when you buy your next business trip at Upside.com. That's code FTN. Upside.com. You deserve a better business trip. Minimum purchase required. See site for complete details.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, remembering the victims of the Las Vegas massacre.
He led his life with honor, dignity, and a great capacity for others.
Reports of a rift between the president and his secretary of state, what sources are telling our Stephen Portnoy.
Rex Tillerson has felt that he has been undermined by the White House.
How will renegade surfer turn the sport upside down?
The surfing community has, you know, embraced me at times and rejected me in other times.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend with the investigation into the Las Vegas massacre. We're learning the gunman, Stephen Paddock, booked a room in Chicago this summer at a hotel near one of America's largest music festivals, Lollapalooza. It could be a sign, officials believe, that Paddock was eyeing other cities and venues as targets.
2 months before, Stephen Paddock fired into a crowd of 22,000 country music fans in Las Vegas.
Wait.
A police source confirmed to CBS News Paddock booked two rooms at the Blackstone Hotel in Chicago. Paddock never showed up, but the hotel overlooks Grant Park, where Lollapalooza was taking place. The four-day music festival attracted some 400,000 people, including Sasha and Malia Obama. At this weekend's Chicago Marathon, police say security will be beefed up.
We're putting a significantly larger number of undercover officers. They're going to be intermingled with the crowd. They're going to be around the runners. They're going to be at the finish line. They're going to be at the start line.
CBS Boston station WBZ reports Paddock searched for hotel rooms near Fenway Park and concert venues in the city. There is no evidence he actually traveled to Boston. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker.
We and many others are fully plugged in on that investigation, and there is no imminent threat to anything in Massachusetts anymore.
Paddock's motive has so far eluded investigators, and one may never be found, says Randy Sutton, a 23-year veteran of the Las Vegas police.
That's probably the most frustrating part of this investigation so far, is that he doesn't fit the profile that anyone would have expected.
Investigators are also looking at Paddock's gun purchases, especially the ones he made in November and December of last year. That's when he bought a shotgun in Las Vegas, a rifle in California, and a couple of handguns at another gun store in Nevada.
Correspondent Vladimir Dutier reporting from Las Vegas. Memorial services and funerals are underway there. Our correspondent Steve Futterman filed this report on the tributes Thursday night to a police officer killed in the attack.
Thousands showed up for a candlelight vigil paying respect to Charlie Hartfield. He was the Las Vegas off-duty police officer who was killed here on Sunday night. Members of the Las Vegas Police Department, friends and relatives, and ordinary citizens who simply wanted to say goodbye showed up. For some of those paying respect, it was emotional.
He led his life with honor, dignity, and a great capacity for others.
Charlie Hartfield was 34 years old. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Las Vegas.
Security at events across the country is being tightened this weekend with music festivals and large events in Austin, Memphis, and Chicago.
In Texas, organizers of the Austin City Limits Music Festival are even offering refunds to ticket holders with safety concerns. In Memphis, the inaugural Mempho Music Festival is expected to draw more than 10,000 people. Organizer Diego Weingartner says his team has been working on security measures for the better part of a year.
We went back and revisited that plan this week. We've made some enhancements.
They always say that, you know, just like
the police and fire will be out in extra force for the next week or two.
Paul Wertheimer is a concert security expert who started studying the issue after 11 people died in a stampede at a concert by The Who in 1979. He says the key to saving lives is having a good evacuation plan.
Is the evacuation plan effective, or is it just a generic plan? And even if it's effective or generic, does anyone even know how to execute it?
He says he's seen nothing yet that makes him believe there was such a plan in Las Vegas.
Jamie Yukis reporting. As the aftermath of the Las Vegas attack played out, police tried to push back against fake news. Let's talk now with CBS News technology consultant Larry Magid. Larry, what was some of the most concerning fake news about the attack you saw?
Well, one instance is that they identified a person of interest, I guess, who really had nothing to do with the shooting, who wound up getting harassed. And then there are victims who really weren't even on the scene who were identified. Some were real people, which must have caused concern for their relatives and maybe even them, and others were fake people. And then also it was blamed on ISIS, and there were lots of reports in the media that ISIS was responsible. There were some reports that the shooter was supposedly had left-wing ties, even though so far there is no indication of his political affiliations or motives. So just a lot of misinformation floating out there, some of it I think because of carelessness, some maybe a sick sense of humor, and in other cases it may have been politically motivated.
Facebook said it responded, taking action. What did it do, and did other social media sites follow suit?
Yeah, I think what happened with both Facebook and Google is that it got somehow put front and center. In the case of Google, it actually came up with a major news story, one of the fake news accounts, and Google said that their algorithms quickly corrected, but there was a while there where it was up there. And the same thing with Facebook. It wound up showing up on people's news feeds as if it were somehow an important story. And, of course, important or not, it was fake. And so they both took some kind of corrective actions. I think in the case of Google, it was an algorithm. But in any case, these are companies that obviously don't want their platforms being used for fake news and were a bit embarrassed by the fact that that was exactly what was happening.
How seriously, then, is Silicon Valley taking fake news, especially when it happens in the background of such a heinous attack?
Well, I think it's being taken seriously, but I think that we have a long way to go before we can deal with it, because sometimes, first of all, one person's fake news is another person's interpretation or opinion, and so I think companies like Facebook are reluctant to pull the plug too quickly until they are absolutely sure it's fake, and now what they're doing is they're saying it's disputed. But, you know, I don't know. I think they need to get much more serious, maybe in a sense the way they deal with child pornography, where they have very good policies and algorithms in place to try to detect it and remove it. But they're not there yet with fake news, and I think it's going to be much more difficult than it is with child pornography, because it's not as if you have a finite set of images that you can compare against a database. These things are constantly coming out with new data and morphing as the stories evolve.
Is there anyone saying that this is an attack on the freedom of information and free speech?
There are some who would argue that suppressing fake news is an attack on free speech, and others would just simply argue that you're correcting the record, and this is, you know, people have a right to their opinions and their interpretations, but not a right to make up lies. I think it's more the danger of false positive, that you identify something, accuse it of being fake news, and then find out that it isn't. You have to be very careful when you start giving anyone, whether on the left, the right, or the middle, the right to start blocking what they consider to be fake news until you're absolutely sure that it, in some objective sense of the word, it really is.
CBS News technology consultant Larry Magid on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Still to come, the bombshell report on Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in the Trump administration.
The report was a blockbuster one. It went all around Washington in minutes.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Let's talk about the week in Washington now. Correspondent Stephen Portnoy is on the line from the White House. Thanks for talking with us, Stephen.
Hey, you bet, Steve.
Stephen, what have we learned about the relationship between Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and the president after reports say Tillerson called Trump a moron, something Tillerson didn't outright deny when addressing reporters Wednesday?
Though his spokesperson, Heather Nauert, later did say that he never said it. But what a remarkable situation on Wednesday of this past week, as the Secretary of State came to cameras to refute this report that he had to be counseled by Vice President Pence to stay on, that he had had thoughts of leaving, and that he had called the president a moron at a meeting of senior national security aides in the Pentagon's tank. The report was a blockbuster one. It went all around Washington in minutes. And ultimately, the president of the United States said that he had confidence in Tillerson, that he was honored by some of Tillerson's remarks in that extraordinary statement he made on Wednesday morning, and that in the end, they have warm relations. But clearly, sources are telling us that clearly it's not as simple as it seems. I mean, Rex Tillerson has felt that he has been undermined by the White House in terms of his role as America's top diplomat in shaping the foreign policy. And it comes as the president nears this decision point on Iran. Rex Tillerson and other top national security aides have in the past recommended that President Trump certify that Iran is in technical compliance with the nuclear deal. The president, twice now, has begrudgingly gone along with that recommendation. He is not inclined to do it a third time. And that is at least one element of this rift that's developed between the Secretary of State and the president. On North Korea, last weekend, the president tweeted that Rex is a wonderful Secretary of State, but he should stop wasting his time after signaling that the U.S. is engaged in direct talks with the North Koreans.
The Trump administration, Stephen, as you know, also made a move Friday to allow employers to opt out of providing no-cost birth control to women by claiming religious or moral objections. We'd been expecting this, though, right?
That's right, because it follows on an executive order that the president signed in May of this year. And this was a determination by the Justice Department of how to carry it forward. Essentially, the Justice Department is saying that any company that expresses any sincerely held religious objection to contraception can evade the federal rule that requires that it be covered under that company's insurance plan. The Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case ruled that the Obama administration erred when it required closely held private companies to provide contraception to their workers. This move by the Trump administration expands it widely and essentially gives the permission to any company, no matter how big or small, to and maybe even publicly traded, we don't know, to see if they want to evade the rule by saying that they have a sincerely held religious objection to contraception. And it's sure to spark a round of legislation.
Finally, Stephen, what should we expect to hear about the Iran deal?
The Iran deal decision point is October 15th. That's next weekend. And the president has been signaling publicly and his aides privately that he is not inclined to certify that Iran is in compliance with the deal. Now, that wouldn't by itself kill the Iran deal. It would send the matter to Congress. The Iran Nuclear Deal Review Act that Congress passed after Barack Obama agreed to this deal with the Iranians and the other countries back in 2015, requires the president every 90 days to take a look at Iran and see whether it's in compliance with the deal. Now, Donald Trump has done that twice now. As I've said, he's not inclined to do it a third time. This would trigger a 60-day period during which Congress could fast-track sanctions legislation. If it winds up on the president's desk and he signs it, that could undermine, if not unwind, the deal. The Iranians would see the U.S. in breach, and the Iranians then theoretically would go back to enriching uranium, and then we're right back where we were years ago. What could happen, though, is Congress could do nothing, and top Republicans seem to have very little appetite to deal with this issue right now. Their plate's rather full.
Yeah, they've got so many other issues distracting them at the moment that I'm sure they don't want one more thing added to their plate.
Namely, tax reform. The president will continue pushing for tax reform in the weeks to come because he really wants a win. He still hasn't had a big one yet.
CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy at the White House. Thanks again, Stephen.
You bet, Steve.
Anti-abortion Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Tim Murphy announced Thursday he will resign October 21st. It follows texts between he and an alleged mistress that suggests he urged her to have an abortion, and reports of a hostile workplace at his office.
It is not just some amorphous cells there floating about, but these are real beings.
For more than a decade on Capitol Hill, Pennsylvania Congressman Tim Murphy has backed a pro-life agenda.
And we have every right to protect those lives. It is part of our responsibility as men and as fathers.
But according to the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, in January, Murphy's alleged mistress, Shannon Edwards, texted him saying, "You have zero issue posting your pro-life stance all over the place when you had no issue asking me to abort our unborn child just last week." Murphy reportedly responded, "I get what you say about my March for Life messages. I've never written them. Staff does them."
The bill is passed.
The story unfolded just as the House approved legislation Tuesday that would make abortions after 20 weeks illegal. Murphy, a member of the House Pro-Life Caucus, co-sponsored and voted for the bill. The Post-Gazette also obtained a memo reportedly written by Murphy's chief of staff in June that claims staffers have been exposed to angry, aggressive, and abusive behavior from the congressman, which has led to a nearly 100% turnover within 1 year's time. On a recent visit to his home district, she writes, "Your driving was dangerous and erratic. I repeatedly, at least 15 times, asked you to stop texting." Murphy's hostility and insults, she adds, were frightening. Murphy's ex-mistress's pregnancy scare turned out to be a false alarm. Nancy Cordes, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
We were first to report Friday that the State Department says it's received a handful of reports from American citizens, civilians, who've reported symptoms similar to those of U.S. government personnel mysteriously attacked in Havana, Cuba for nearly a year. The State Department says it can verify the reports from private American citizens, but it did issue a security message to U.S. citizens warning about two Havana hotels and imposing government restrictions on them. It comes after on Tuesday the State Department announced it's expelling 15 Cuban embassy personnel in Washington from the country in order to have equity in staffing at the U.S. embassy in Havana, where the U.S. pulled out most of its staff and all families. Director of the University of Nottingham Center for Research on Cuba, Professor Anthony Capcia.
They certainly have gone back at least one or more steps. And the mood music, which was good under Obama, is clearly no longer good. So I suspect that this is not going to help that at all.
Cuba has denied any involvement. Up next, rebuilding Puerto Rico on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Like what you're hearing? Get even more great content from CBS News Radio podcasts. Listen to TV broadcasts like The Evening News and Face the Nation on demand, or hear original audio programming like our weekend review show, The Weekend Roundup. Get politics, policy, and a side of pop culture with White House correspondent Major Garrett on our newest show, The Takeout. Get these podcasts and more from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. President Trump on Tuesday visited Puerto Rico to survey the progress to rebuild and get power and water back on for millions on the island in the wake of Hurricanes Maria and Irma. The president praised recovery efforts there despite criticism his administration was slow to respond.
We're getting a lot of generators have been already brought to the island. Most of the hospitals are open, or at least partially open, but most of them now are open. And again, the job that's been done here is really nothing short of a miracle.
Correspondent Bill Rakoff spoke with CBS's David Begno, who was on the ground for 17 days in Maria's aftermath there doing tireless work.
Puerto Rico continuing to recover from the hurricane Maria, which came ashore with such ferocity and left devastation in its wake, there to chronicle it on the ground as it happened and in the aftermath with CBS News' David Begno, who is back from Puerto Rico now and joins us for a bit of conversation. First of all, David, welcome. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
What were your expectations going in? Was it any different than what you'd done before?
The governor set the tone. I remember the day before the storm made landfall, he went to an area where flooding was expected and he told people this could be the worst case scenario. And he said everything he had heard said that it was going to be the worst storm the island had ever hit. And he was right. The question is exactly what were they planning to do? And that'll be a right question to ask at a later date. But right now, at least for 14 days, they've been in an emergency scenario. And what has made this storm unlike any natural disaster I've covered is that usually on the third to fourth day, they move into a recovery mode. But in Puerto Rico, 14 days after the storm made landfall, they were still trying to just get food, water, and fuel to the people who so desperately needed it.
And a lot was made about how the response was handled, which we can talk about in just a little bit. But you were one of the first reporters to suggest that it necessarily wasn't an issue with getting enough aid to the island. You pointed out and was one of the first reporters to point out the fact that the aid was there. The problem was, and there were a number of factors in this, getting that aid off the docks to the people who needed it.
I'll never forget the governor saying to me, "We've got the food, it's at the port." And I said, "Well, how does it leave the port?" And he said, "We don't have the drivers." And I said, "What do you mean you don't have the drivers?" And he said, "They're not here." And I said, "For what reason?" And he said, "Well, either because their home was destroyed, or they don't have enough gas to get to work, or they have to tend to their family." And I said, "So what are you going to do?" And he said, "Well, we're looking for anybody who will help." I said, "Anybody?" He said, "Yep, if you've got a driver's license, you can drive a truck, come on down." He said, "We'll even take school bus drivers." So I said, "Where can we see this?" So he pointed out where to go, and we went. And sure enough, there were 3,000 shipping containers sitting in the port of San Juan. Now, these were containers with supplies that were going to supermarkets, private businesses that were going to restock store shelves. But the drivers weren't showing up. And so on this day when they were begging for food and water, you see 3,000 shipping containers waiting to go out, and the governor saying, "There's not much I can do about it." Eventually, FEMA came in and started buying up what was in those boxes and started sending them out. You had enough supplies to help a 500,000 people, and they were sitting there. This was probably 4 days after the storm made landfall, just sitting there.
CBS's David Begno is joining with us now, back from Puerto Rico after his amazing Hurricane Maria coverage. You know, one of the things that we heard about was that the city of San Juan itself was able to get some services back in short order. But what we found out as the days and even, as you point out, a week or two go by, and we find out that the interior parts of the island are some of the places where people have still yet to get. Give me your first impressions going into those areas.
In the area of Utuado, where we sent a team, we at first wanted to track down this rumor that it was paralyzing people on the island, that bodies and caskets were floating in a graveyard. So we sent a producer and a crew, and come to find out there was a police officer who said, "It's not true, and I'm actually here to provide protection for the area to turn people away." So we continued in Utuado, and we saw people who were drinking water from a stream, bathing with it, trying to get the essentials. I talked to a man who sent me a photo of the kiddie pool that he bought because he was using the pool to collect the water that had come from the rain and fell from his roof. That is how desperate they are.
David, I had a friend of mine respond to a Facebook post. I had shared one of your stories, and they said that, you know, watching your coverage as time went on, they felt like it was, they could see a change in you, the reporter. What did you take away from this personally as a journalist, and did it change you?
It's interesting you asked that. Several people have said that. And I don't know that I looked in the mirror and saw a change, but I will tell you this. I came back with a feeling of responsibility, perhaps, that I had never felt before coming back from a story. You know, when you get into journalism, you dream of making a difference. The professors and the mentors tell you about journalism is meant to uphold the truth, the pursuit of the truth. And if along the way you can do something to help people, it's even better. When I got to Puerto Rico, it was like, every story we've done, it's a hurricane. You're there to cover it. When I left, what I encountered were people who felt like the coverage was a lifeline. That's not something we planned. It's not something we said, you know what? This is going to help the organization, bring publicity. We just did what we always do. But it happened to be some of the only way that people were able to find out what was going on in the island. I remember a man coming up to me at the airport in San Juan crying uncontrollably, saying that he felt like the coverage had helped to save lives. I hope it did. We're not looking for any credit. That's not what we went there for. But to the extent that it actually helped people, I think it's the best piece of journalism that I've ever seen, thanks to my crew, which made it possible.
CBS's David Begno doing yeoman's work in Puerto Rico. Thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure.
Tropical Storm Nate is threatening the U.S. as it approaches the Gulf Coast this weekend from Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. More from correspondent Michelle Miller in New Orleans.
The main concern of this system remains storm surge. Some low-lying areas of Louisiana have already been ordered to evacuate. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards has activated 1,300 National Guard troops across the state, including 15 assigned to New Orleans to monitor those pumps.
If we get exactly what's forecasted, it's going to be serious.
And this system is slowing down oil production in the Gulf. 15% of production offline. That's about 254,000 barrels of crude oil every single day.
There's new concerns about what the 2011 Japanese tsunami has brought to the U.S. KXL Radio's Grant McKill reports from Portland, Oregon.
A team of researchers from Portland State University have found that nearly 300 foreign aquatic species have landed on American shores since the tsunami by hitching rides on man-made debris. And ecologist Brian Steve says that's a concern.
We have to be worried it's going to take hold and become an established population.
He says that of the 300 species found, currently only three are known to be invasive elsewhere around the world, but not on the West Coast. And so now, he says his team of scientists will wait to see what happens with the rest.
Whether there's any place along the West Coast here where they might be able to take hold.
Grant McHill for CBS News, Portland, Oregon.
Coming up on the weekend roundup, a new report says Americans are paying more than ever to get their own money from ATMs.
Yeah, sometimes they charge $3, $2, and then also the bank charges you on top of that.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A winner of the Nobel Peace Prize has been announced. More from CBS News correspondent Terry Okita in London.
To the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, ICAN.
The announcement came as a surprise to the Geneva-based group.
Really overwhelmed about this. It's a huge honor.
For the past decade, ICAN activists have been trying to convince nuclear-armed nations to prohibit and eliminate their weapons programs.
You can't threaten to indiscriminately slaughter hundreds of thousands of civilians in the name of security. That's not how you build security, and it doesn't make us safer.
The award may send a signal to the U.S. and North Korea that negotiations over nuclear weapons are vital to avoid a humanitarian crisis. It's also a show of support for the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which ICAN pushed for, but President Trump has called an embarrassment and not in America's national interest. ICAN's leader says the Trump presidency has put a spotlight on the risks of nuclear weapons.
The election of President Donald Trump has made a lot of people feel very uncomfortable with the fact that he alone can authorize the use of nuclear weapons, and there's nothing people can do to stop him.
The Nobel Prize Committee says ICAN's work is needed now more than ever to eliminate nuclear weapons. Terry Okita, CBS News, London.
There won't be any awards for a speech given by embattled British Prime Minister Theresa May. To her Conservative Tory Party Wednesday, she was plagued by a coughing fit, then by a prankster who handed her a P45 form, the UK's equivalent to a pink slip. More from the BBC's Norman Smith.
For a Prime Minister already under huge pressure, the sight of Mrs. May struggling with a failing voice to complete her speech risks becoming a defining symbol of her apparent political fragility and vulnerability. At times, it seemed almost as if she would be unable to complete the speech. And at the end, her husband Philip rushed onto the stage to comfort his wife with a consoling hug. The strain on Mrs. May's voice and a persistent cough was evident from early on in her speech.
We will never hesitate to act where businesses aren't operating as they should.
As party members sought to encourage her on, Mrs. May kept having to stop as she tried to recover her voice, at one point even being handed a cough sweep by the Chancellor.
You can't get something for nothing. The Chancellor will probably tell me there'll be a price to pay in a minute for...
Mrs. May had already been unsettled after earlier an extraordinary security lapse allowed a prankster to approach the Prime Minister midway through her speech and hand her a P45, shouting, "Boris asked me to give this to you." That protest, coupled with her fading voice, brought the conference to its feet in a wave of sympathy for Mrs. May, as party members cheered and sought to rally the Prime Minister. Then, in a final indignity, part of the lettering on the conference slogan, "Building a country that works for everyone," fell off the stage backdrop just behind her. a series of setbacks that overshadowed a speech that nevertheless did contain some significant policy and political announcements. Indeed, Mrs. May began with what up to now she has conspicuously avoided, namely a public apology to her party for the general election.
It was too scripted, too presidential, and it allowed the Labour Party to paint us as the voice of continuity when the public wanted to hear a message of change. I hold my hands up for that. I take responsibility. I led the campaign, and I am sorry.
There were also two major policy announcements: the energy price cap, promised in the Tory Party manifesto and then abandoned in the Queen's speech, was to be brought forward again with draft legislation to be introduced in Parliament next week. And, said Mrs. May, there would be a major council house building programme with an extra £2 billion to pay for it.
A new generation of council houses to help fix our broken housing market.
Elsewhere, the Prime Minister acknowledged that the Brexit negotiations were proving frustrating, restated the case for free markets, and announced there'd be a consultation to introduce a system in England of presumed consent for organ donation. And Mrs. May described her mission as to renew the British dream, where each succeeding generation could do better than their parents.
That's what I'm in politics for, to make a difference, to change things for the better, to hand on to the next generation a country that is stronger, fairer and more prosperous, and to renew the British dream for a new generation again.
In an age when visual images can often convey more than words, the pictures of Mrs. May struggling so very publicly may well leave a lasting impression. For some, a symbol of the Prime Minister's resolve and determination to carry on. For others, a symbol of a leader losing not just her physical voice, but perhaps her political voice, and with it, her authority as Prime Minister.
Back home, the logging industry is turning to a new generation. More from correspondent Kenneth Craig in East Millinocket, Maine.
We're in beautiful downtown TAR7.
TAR7 is what the locals call this plot of forest in the middle of Maine, where the deep woods serve as a classroom for the state's next generation of loggers.
We're giving them, as students, the very foundation of what it takes to be a logger.
Ben Tuttle is a student in the new mechanized logging program through Northern Maine Community College. His dad is a logger, and he fell in love with the trade as a kid.
The cool equipment and how big it was and just being in the woods.
The logging business today is a far cry from the lumberjacks of yesteryear, and it's at a critical turning point. In the digital age, demand for paper has dropped dramatically.
It's good to meet you.
And Senator Angus King says Maine's forest industry has taken a major hit. To keep it alive, he's counting on a process called cross-laminated timber,
which is timber put together in a certain way that makes it super strong, and you can build 8- and 10-story buildings with it instead of steel.
Logging is now done with high-tech machinery and GPS systems, which require extra training.
There's a lot of acres, millions of acres, in wood. So that means there's a lot of money just waiting for that next product.
While it's not what it used to be, logging is still a multi-billion-dollar industry in Maine with a shortage of workers. And students here are hoping to put down roots. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, East Millinocket, Maine.
Coming up, we speak to big wave surfer Laird Hamilton on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Check out CBS News Radio podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Anthony Mason every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our Week in Review magazine show. It's all available from cbsnewsradio.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Sexual harassment allegations have surfaced against one of Hollywood's biggest producers. More from correspondent Elaine Quijano.
The sexual harassment allegations against Harvey Weinstein stretch back 30 years, with some as recent as 2015, according to the New York Times. One of his accusers, actress Ashley Judd, told the paper that two decades ago, Weinstein made multiple sexual advances at a Beverly Hills hotel, asking if he could give her a massage or watch him shower. I said no, a lot of ways, a lot of times, and he always came back at me with some new ask, Judd recalled. She thought, how do I get out of the room as fast as possible without alienating Harvey Weinstein? The Times reports that eight women say Weinstein engaged in inappropriate behavior that included appearing nearly or fully naked in front of them, requiring them to be present while he bathed, or repeatedly asking for a massage or initiating one himself. And the paper says Weinstein has reached at least eight confidential settlements with women. Among them are former assistants, an actress, and a model. The paper says most received roughly $80,000 to $150,000. In a written statement to the Times, Weinstein said, quote, I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behavior and workplaces were different. I appreciate the way I've behaved with colleagues in the past has caused a lot of pain, and I sincerely apologize for it. One half of the powerhouse Weinstein film studio, Harvey Weinstein's resume includes hits like Pulp Fiction, Good Will Hunting, and Shakespeare in Love.
In a statement to CBS News, Weinstein's attorney, Charles Harder, said the New York Times had published false and defamatory statements about Harvey Weinstein, adding, "We are preparing the lawsuit now. All proceeds will be donated to women's organizations." Elaine Quijano, CBS News, New York.
Legendary surfer Laird Hamilton has pioneered the sport of riding huge waves.
He was just fearless.
We all thought he was crazy.
Laird would do these things that nobody'd ever seen.
When he was out there surfing, it was like he was in his backyard playing with his toys.
That's a clip from the new film Take Every Wave, The Life of Laird Hamilton. It focuses on the life and career of big wave surfer Laird Hamilton. He's captivated the surfing world, but also rejected many parts of it, refusing to compete professionally. Laird Hamilton and director Rory Kennedy join us on the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rory, first, tell me about what's special about the film, especially for folks not familiar with surfing.
The story of the film is quite compelling. You know, Laird's a fascinating character who's had a really interesting life, and I think that he's really managed to push himself into situations that I think for the rest of us are unimaginable when you see him surfing down these waves that look like avalanches or the sizes of New York City buildings. It's pretty extraordinary. But he's also been an innovator and changed the sport of surfing single-handedly more than any other person over the last 50 years.
Rory mentioned how you've changed the sport. Laird, tell me how you've seen surfing evolve since the 1960s, and what's different now?
Well, I was fortunate enough to grow up in a time when the shortboard revolution, where they were changing board design, and then, you know, since then, what's happened is that we've been able to start to ride waves that were up until now, you know, unrideable. Because of the size of them, and then just the maneuvers and the boards that we use to ride the waves. I mean, there's so many new different disciplines, you know, besides the fact that we're riding waves, and then a lot of people are riding waves that were considered impossible to ride.
Laird, part of the film centers on your life as a kid. What was that like?
I grew up kind of in a broken home, which is I don't think is unusual to many people. I grew up under a certain amount of racial tension, which I don't think that's, you know, unique to me. I grew up on one of the most dangerous beaches in the world, which might be a little more unique to me. I had an amazing mother. I had heroic type men that I was exposed to being around. And actually my stepfather. So I think there's a uniqueness. You know, they say every snowflake is different. Well, I think every person's different. I have a few things that are similar to everybody, and then a few things that aren't.
Rory, some of the shots in the film are pretty amazing. I know you use a bit of archival footage, but how did you get some of these crazy shots in the center of Many Waves?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. You know, we struggled with trying to figure out the best way to capture Laird. The story that we were following, the Verite story, current day story that we were following of Laird, was him foil boarding during the El Nino season and trying to find, you know, a really big long wave, which eventually came our way in Hawaii, off of Kauai. At the end of, you know, about a year and a half ago when we were filming. And so we struggled on how to capture him on that, whether we should use drones or film from a jet ski or film from the water. And ultimately, we decided to really do it from a helicopter.
Back to you, Laird. Tell me, what has the reaction been to your career from the surfing community?
Oh, it's been a mixed emotions. I mean, I think the surfing community has, you know, embraced me at times and rejected me in other times. I think it varies depending on what I'm doing. I've really had little support, really, from the surf industry itself. I've never had one of the mainstream surf companies sponsor me, and because of my lack of participation in the world tour itself, I'm usually not, you know, on that platform, which is a majority of the industry is kind of based around that. So, you know, I think they embrace me when I do things that kind of they understand, and then they don't embrace me when I do things that they don't understand. So, which is, I think, is probably pretty human. It's pretty normal.
Renegade and pioneer surfer Laird Hamilton and director Rory Kennedy talking to CBS News Radio about the new film Take Every Wave, The Life of Laird Hamilton. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for the weekend roundup. Thanks for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your story ideas, chain letters, love letters, whatever, to Weekend Roundup at cbsnews.com. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and now Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dory Valerio is the production assistant in New York. Alyssa Rashaw is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.